Good morning, all. The first case for argument this morning is Jones versus Wilhelm. Mr. Hazelbaker.
Good morning, Your Honor, members of the court. If it pleases the court, the key fact to keep in mind in evaluating this case is that the time it took me to walk from my seat to the podium represents about the time that the officers here had to decide what to do when they found themselves at the door of the apartment in question, possessed of the search warrant, without knowledge of what was beyond that door. In the time that we talked about in our brief of being 5 seconds, they had to decide based on their knowledge of the circumstances, their experience, and the response of the people inside what to do.
Mr. Hazelbaker, does the record reflect whether this was an apartment with one entrance or two?
The record reflects, Your Honor, that the apartment building had two entrances.
The building. But
the building did.
The apartment, that's really what my inquiry is. I understand there's a rear stairway and a front, but I guess I'm just, because the facts sometimes play such a critical role here.
I don't think that...
Can we tell whether it's just that door or whether there could have been another exit from the apartment, I guess is my question.
The only way we could infer that is that it's on the second floor, but of course it's possible there could be rear stairs, but that fact isn't in the record.
I mean just another exit from the apartment to the hallway even. That's
no, I don't believe there is, but I'm not sure you'll find that in the record.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. What happened here was that the officers decided to act, some might say precipitously, but I would say cautiously. They knocked on the door, hearing no response, sensing no response, they proceeded to break the door down, enter the apartment, and then executed the standard protocol that officers use in securing a search warrant. They put the people on the floor, handcuffed them, and then, of course, unfortunately discovered that they had entered the wrong apartment. And we certainly regret very much the fact that they entered the wrong apartment. But the fact that a mistake was made is not, of course, per se proof that liability should attach or that there is no qualified immunity.
But here we had a situation where the officer had been to the apartment more than 10 times to observe, knew the names of the individuals who were the targets. Shouldn't he have at least looked on the mailboxes to check which apartment it was? So
well,
this wasn't like an officer who had no knowledge. You know, I wouldn't have a problem with the argument you're making if he had no knowledge whatsoever, but he knew the names, and the names were on the mailboxes, and the mailboxes were at the front door.
Except that he didn't, well, what happened, of course, which gave rise to this situation is that from the observations that he had been making and viewing the pattern of activity at the apartment building, he connected up the pattern of activity and with the ambiguity in the search warrant concluded that the apartment to the north, which is the Jones apartment, was the one where the trafficking occurred.
And I understand he was looking at people coming back and forth from the back entrance, but they chose to go in the front entrance, and the front entrance is where the mailboxes were, as I understand the fact, or maybe I'm off on that. And the mailboxes had the names, and he knew the names of the individuals.
The names, yes, he knew the names, although I can only say that he was confronted by a description of which apartment to seize and search, not which people. It said search the apartment at the top of the stairs on the right. And when he was confronted by that, he made the decision to go ahead with the search and to add to the warrant the knowledge that he had gained from surveillance. So I guess my answer to your question is that he couldn't, based on the warrant, supplemented in the manner in which you're speaking. He felt he had to supplement it by his field observations and what seemed to him to be reasonably probable based on the pattern of activity.
Who had supplied affidavits in support of the warrant?
Detective Finch, who is another detective of the Sheriff's Department. She was the one who had overheard that a car had gone off the road in rural Burnett County. She recognized the license plate of the car from an investigation she was working on, and the fact that there were a couple of canisters of anhydrous ammonia in the trunk were kind of led her to believe that it might have something to do with methamphetamine.
And what part had Officer Wilhelm played in the pre-warrant investigation?
None. He was the person who, as the director of the county's SWAT team, the special tactics team, actually executed the warrant. His part in, well, I shouldn't say he had no part in the investigation. He had a part in that he had been independently performing surveillance. He had never talked to Deputy Finch, Detective Finch, the detective who procured the warrant, about the surveillance of this property. Those two tracks were going on independently. And the first time that the facts connected up was at the point in time when Deputy Wilhelm received the warrant from Deputy Finch, recognized the address as the building where he had been doing surveillance, and then formed the connection that I've mentioned.
So the analysis he went through on that evening was basically the of deciding it must be the apartment with the traffic as opposed to the one with the blankets, etc. That's the stuff of affidavits in support of a warrant, isn't it? I mean, you submit that kind of stuff to a magistrate, and the magistrate decides whether you've got enough for the warrant. That's the way it usually works, right?
Yes. And
so in fact, this guy was performing a magisterial duty on the spot, wasn't he, rather than going back to the magistrate.
An interesting point, but I think what he was actually doing is what some case law has recognized officers are allowed to do in the field when confronted with a search warrant that is ambiguous or incomplete. They're allowed to supplement that with their own knowledge. I'm aware, of course, Your Honor, that the case law does say that the purpose of the magistrate is to test the sufficiency of information in the possession of investigative officers. In this case, though, there wasn't a question about whether there was probable cause. That's the purpose for which we need the review of a magistrate, to test those facts.
Whether there was probable cause to go into the apartment they were going to go in was a question.
That's true.
And as it turned out, they didn't have probable cause to go into that apartment.
That's true. They did not.
How do you square, you know, because there is some ambiguity in the search warrant in terms of which apartment, how do you square that with Jacobs, which is a case that suggests that once they realize there's an ambiguity, they need to do some investigation to try to clear that up? Because I think that's part of what's going on here. And so that's where I think the indication of the individuals that he had the names of and that were on the mailbox, that's where that, I think, fits in.
I think our response would be that he genuinely believed in good faith that the ambiguity arose only when they had actually entered the apartment and seen the wrong people. I see that I'm in my rebuttal time, so if I may.
Did you have any other questions?
No.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Hazelbaker. Mr. Olson?
May it please the Court, Mr. Hazelbaker, there's one thing that's not crystal clear from the briefs in this case, and that's that this case came before the district court on cross motions for summary judgment. To decide our motion, the court was required to credit everything Deputy Wilhelm said, particularly that he had surveilled the Jones apartment building 10 times and seen heavy traffic going in the back door each time, followed by activity in the Jones's apartment. But to decide the defense motion, including the qualified immunity defense, the court was required to reject Wilhelm's testimony about his observations because Mark Jones testified in his declaration that nobody came up to the Jones's apartment via the rear door because there were no working doorbells there and the door was always locked. Now, on the Wilhelm version, the district court found that entering the Jones's apartment was objectively unreasonable. It was completely incomprehensible for the purposes of qualified immunity, accepting Mark Jones's version of the facts. The same factual considerations control the disposition of the knock and announce claim. We didn't move for summary judgment on the knock and announce claim because we knew we would lose. We would have been stuck with the testimony most favorable to the defense, which was we knocked and announced, and then we waited 15 seconds, then we kicked the door in. But on their motion, including their motion for qualified immunity, we win because then the court takes the testimony most favorable to the plaintiff to the effect that there was a knock, Then there was a delay of maybe 3 to 5 seconds. Then there was the announcement and no delay before Sucharski kicked the door in. Sucharski said, I gave the announcement and I kicked the door in as soon as I could step back and get my foot up. On that version of events, there's no suggestion that qualified immunity applies, and that's the version the court has to take in deciding a qualified immunity defense. The district court opinion seems to have been written by two different people. For example, at page 16 it says, there's a common sense presumption that a warrant's directions are oriented to main, primary, or public entrances, and it goes on to cite 3 or 4 cases. But then at page 25 in the qualified immunity section, the district court says, quote, plaintiffs have not cited, and I am not aware of, any cases holding that warrants must be read from the perspective of a person using the building's primary or public entrance. Well, you can't have it both ways. Either you read the warrants from a person's from the perspective of somebody using the main entrance, or you don't. If you do, the warrant unambiguously identifies the Grunewald apartment. And if you don't, or you can't tell, then it's ambiguous. The district court held that from the information defendant Wilhelm had, he concluded that plaintiff's apartment was the one described in the warrant, and then the district court said, and I quote, this conclusion was objectively unreasonable. But then the way the district court got from there to granting qualified immunity was at page 23, when it said, plaintiffs have not cited any case showing that defendant Wilhelm should have known that the conclusions he drew from his personal observations were unreasonable. Well, that's not the issue, because it skips a step by starting the analysis with only those observations Wilhelm had chosen to make. The issue is, after he realized the warrant was ambiguous, that is, that it did not on its face clearly describe the place to be searched, one, was it clearly established in the law that the Fourth Amendment required Deputy Wilhelm to stop his search at least until he had undertaken reasonable efforts to avoid error, to ascertain the place to be searched? And two, was that standard, reasonable efforts to ascertain the place to be searched, clear enough, either on its face or by virtue of existing case law, that a reasonable officer who knew the law would have known that he should look at the names and apartment numbers of the building residents posted by the doorbell?
Well, was that information conveyed to him, that is Wilhelm, the exact name of the individuals? I know Finch was told the names by the informant, but did Wilhelm learn the names of the individuals?
Wilhelm testified that he knew that the occupant of the apartment was Jody Grunewald or Jody Anderson. The actual name was Jody Grunewald hyphen Anderson. Wilhelm testified that he took his pocket knife and opened the door by inserting the pocket knife into the latch. There's pictures in the Jones Declaration on this. Right next to that latch, the latch is here and the doorbells are here, and above the doorbells are names and apartment numbers.
So even though he didn't get the information from Finch, because of his investigation, he knew those names.
He got it from Finch. He did get the information from Finch. It was not in the affidavit, but it had been independently conveyed to him from Finch. He said that.
Prior to the search.
Prior to the search. He knew the name. If he would have looked either at the mailboxes or the doorbells with their labels, he would have known which apartment to go into. And I differ with the defense on this. I think the Jacobs case clearly says that the information posted by the doorbells was one of the things that led the court to hold that reasonable officers would have known they were at a multi-unit building. In Maryland versus Garrison, in contrast, the information posted by the doorbells would not have told the officers that there were two apartments on the third floor,
They had a warrant that looked like there were just one apartment on the third floor, and the information by the doorbells would have disabused them of that. It just identified the names and apartment numbers, but not the floor numbers, as far as we can tell from reading the opinion. The defense reply brief repeatedly says that Wilhelm did not know the warrant was ambiguous. Well, he clearly did. In the testimony that we cite in a footnote at page 55 of our principal brief, our only brief, I ask him, I say the warrant was ambiguous, wasn't it? And he says, yeah, I couldn't tell which staircase or which door the confidential informant came up. Here's the interesting question. It looks from Marilyn and Garrison, and it looks from Jacobs like at the point that he realized the warrant was ambiguous, he had a duty to discontinue his search. And then, what was his duty at that point? Well, it was either, as Judge Ripple's question suggested, to go back to the magistrate and let the magistrate perform the function of more particularly describing the place to be searched based on a judicial weighing of probable cause, or it was at the very least, in the words of Marilyn and Garrison, to undertake reasonable efforts to ascertain the particular place to be searched. And he didn't do either one. And based on that, we believe the court should grant summary judgment to the plaintiff on the wrong apartment claim, because even crediting Deputy Wilhelm's testimony about his surveillance observations, number one, he said in this same testimony we quote in our brief, the activity he observed could be innocent. And number two, his observations had not been sufficiently suggestive of unlawful activity in the Joneses' apartment to even lead him to check to learn who lived there. That's how unconvinced he was there was any criminal activity going on there based on these 10 alleged observations. He never even looked to see who lived in that apartment. He says, quote, that was very early on in the investigation as far as surveillance going on. Even crediting that testimony, I think the court has to hold that he had a duty to look at those doorbells and mailboxes in carrying out at least a reasonable effort to avoid error. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Olson. Mr. Hazelbaker.
Thank you, Your Honor. Responding to the comments that my friend and colleague has just made, let me comment that the cases we've cited in our brief, particularly Lewis versus Mount Vernon and Samuels versus Smith, hold that an objectively reasonable belief that the officer is executing the search warrant against the proper house is sufficient to confer qualified immunity upon them. Here, the issue is that the information that Mr. Wilhelm came into independently corroborated the information in the search warrant. Now, in retrospect, we can say, well, he should have done what Attorney Olson says. He should have gone back and got another warrant. The fact of the matter was, and the fact of the matter is, in all of these situations, police officers are confronting situations where there's a concern about the possible loss of evidence, there's a concern about the possible loss of suspects, and they don't have a lot of time to make the decisions. That's why the doctrine of qualified immunity and the enormous amount of discretion given to
police. Where had he originally procured, who had given him the warrant?
Deputy Finch got the warrant.
And he was delivered to the captain who was going to execute it where?
In the village of Grantsburg, Your Honor.
I see. Does the record indicate whether the captain perused the warrant or read the warrant before he set out to execute?
He read the warrant, pardon me, and it was at the point that he read the warrant that he made the connection because of the building address to the property he had been surveilling.
So is it really accurate to say the first time he had an opportunity to find out whether he had a sufficiently specific warrant was at the scene? Didn't he have a chance to read that warrant when it was handed to him and say, in fact, he could have consulted with the officer and said, hey, wait a minute, now, that place has two stairs. Where am I going? He could have covered his bases before he passed the failsafe point.
the record shows that actually he did think about it. He came to the wrong conclusion. In other words, he didn't make a thoughtless decision just to march off without thinking about it.
He took it on himself to make that without consultation.
He used information in his possession to make that decision. And that's why the Fourth Amendment has been read to give officers on the scene enormous latitude, because this is not an exact science. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Hazelbaker, and thank you, Mr. Olson. The case is taken.